Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow now, is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host A. Trunk.
Hey everybody, what's going on? It's Eddie Trunk and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New episodes every Thursday wherever you get your podcast totally free. Thank you for subscribing, listening, and checking it out. It is appreciated. As I tell you every week, the interviews you hear on the Eddie Trunk Podcast originated on my SiriusXM radio show, Trunk Nation, which you can hear on Volume, Channel 106, live weekdays, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, nightly re-airs 10 to midnight Eastern, and anytime you want, audio, video, and more on the SiriusXM app. We have a special all-Canadian podcast for you this week. Coming up a little bit later on, an interview with Mike Levine, the bass player from the band Triumph. Mike called in to talk about the 40th anniversary of the Triumph album Allied Forces, which is actually my favorite album in their catalog, and also their upcoming documentary, which, since we've done this interview, it has been revealed that documentary will indeed come out in the fall. Mike talks a little bit about the documentary, and I can update that interview slightly and tell you that in the couple weeks since this interview happened, they have now set a release date. So looking forward to that coming out towards the back end of the year. We'll talk to Mike about Triumph coming up in just a little bit, but the first part of our Canadian doubleheader this week is with the legendary guitarist of the band Rush, Alex Lifeson. Alex joined me a couple weeks ago to talk about new music that he has released and new music that he's working on, and also a brand new guitar that he has released, a signature guitar through Epiphone. It's great to talk to Alex. Both Alex and Mike are old friends and have been frequent guests on my shows over the decades. And Alex is a guy that really, since Rush disbanded and Neil Peart died, we haven't heard much from. So it was awesome to catch up with him. We'll bring you Alex Lifeson first. We'll follow it up with Mike Levine, an all-Canadian doubleheader, two great rock artists for you this week on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Don't forget, follow me on social media for info and updates on everything going on at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, fan page on Facebook, eddietrunk.com is the website. We got two great interviews, so let's not waste any time. Let's get right to them. Coming up first, right after this, it's Alex Lifeson of Rush. And it's always such an honor and privilege to be joined by this guy. Of course, me and many people listening, lifelong fans of his band Rush, and it's been far too long since we've had an on-the-record conversation or discussion or even just a hello. And it's great to see him because we're doing this on Zoom as well. Joining me is legendary guitarist Alex Lifeson. Alex, wonderful to see you and talk to you. How have you been? How you doing? Okay.
Good, Eddie. Really good, actually. It's been, such a difficult time for all of us in this past year of the pandemic. And it's nice to be coming through it and seeing the light at the end of the tunnel and reconnecting with everybody and starting to live life again.
You know, we're doing this on Zoom, and people will be able to see this on the SiriusXM app when it's posted. But as we were talking during the commercial break before we came on, I'm looking at your backdrop, and it looks like a guitar store of some sort. And I'm seeing all these amazing guitars behind you. I said, Alex, are you in a guitar center, or where are you? And you said this is actually a home studio that you have. For the audience watching, explain where you're at a little bit.
Well, I've always had a home studio, but generally it's been in a house. We moved recently in March, and the library that was in this apartment, I converted into a studio. So I had the room treated for sound, and I brought in a bunch of my old analog gear and a bunch of guitars from my house in the country, and set myself up here. And it's great. It's a great working environment. We're up on the 25th floor with a beautiful view of the outlying area around Toronto, right downtown. And it's an exciting, inspiring place to work. And certainly that's been the case in the last little while. It's been pretty active around here.
So do you use that space just to work, or do you live there as well?
Well, if you ask my wife, I live in here right now. No, this is our apartment. We actually live here, and it's just one of the rooms that, you know, I had. In our last place, we had an office that we shared, so it was okay, but I would drive Charlene crazy working in there, and I didn't want to work on headphones. And so when we decided to move and have a little more space, I thought, for sure, I've got to have a nice working environment. And that's exactly what I have here. I love it. It's a very accurate room. It's really tight, so I'm hearing everything that I want to hear from the speakers. And I've been able to do some really good work here, not only playing and recording, but also some mixing.
So, real quickly, how many guitars do you have? Because behind you, I can see at least a dozen, it looks like. But in your guitar arsenal over the decades, I imagine you're a bit of a guitar nerd, like many guitar players. Do you have a warehouse, so to speak? Do you have a stash of them? Have you collected rare guitars? We all know I had Getty on for his bass book, and Getty's been on with me a couple times about that book, and we all know the passion he has for the bass. Are you the same when it comes to guitars? Do you have that same sort of passion for the instrument, and do you have a big collection like Getty does?
You know, I never started out to be a collector, and although I've collected some instruments of, you know, sort of some kind of value in terms of the vintage or the particular model, I was never a big collector. Now, of course, 45 years later, these brand new guitars that I got back then are vintage instruments. So I probably have, let's see, I you're pretty close. I have 17 guitars here on the wall. I have another eight acoustics on the other side of my desk here. And then in the corner, I've got my mandola and mandolin. I've got a banjo over here, much to my wife's dismay. And so I have a violin here. I have lots of really great instruments that I can utilize and work with. I probably have a total of somewhere around 120 instruments. Getty, on the other hand, I think is around 350, and he did a lot of collecting when he was preparing for his book, and he had also collected some six-string instruments as well. So, but you know, he is a collector. He's always been that way. His baseball memorabilia collection is amazing, and so he's got that bug.
Yeah, no doubt. So you talk about this workload that you're doing and having this studio and the flexibility to be able to record and create when you want to, which is wonderful. You know, I think to the outside fan, between COVID, between losing Neil, between the band retiring, everything that's gone on with you in recent years, the perception might be, well, those guys are just off the radar. They're not doing anything. They're not writing. They're not recording. It sounds like the opposite, even though it really hasn't been public to this point, the opposite actually has been pretty much true, has it not? Because it sounds like we've got two songs coming. We know we've got some stuff what we're going to talk about coming down the line. But it sounds like you've taken recent years to really maybe go into the studio and record and write, whether it be for yourself or other artists. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've always written on my own. I think when really the germ of Victor, which is 25 years now, really happened because, you know, Ged was expecting his second child and he wanted to take a year off, and I didn't want to sit around and not do anything. And so I started working on that project, and I have a lot of material from then that I recorded over the years. And I'd like to release it slowly on my website a little bit at a time and just take this little trip down my own musical memory lane. I think that'd be kind of fun to share some of those ideas. They're sort of demos and maybe more produced demos, but it's an indication of where I was at musically at that time. With the more current stuff, you know, when we finished the tour in 2015, I started writing almost immediately. I wanted to keep, you know, my chops. I wanted to keep in shape. And so a lot of these tracks, including the two that are on the website, were written, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago initially. And of course, I dick around with them over and over and over again. I replace tracks. I add things, take things out. I remix them a couple thousand times. But I guess it, at the end of the day, it's all about keeping active within the scope of what I know how to do and have experience and have done for a long time. And it's really, really satisfying. I don't need to promote it or anything like that when I'm doing it. It's more an exercise to keep me in shape. Of course, now, after enjoying my retirement for the last 5 years, everything's changed in these last 2 weeks. I avoided social media forever. I was very, you know, protective of my privacy, and I didn't want to get involved with the way it works, with all the crazy stuff that goes on. I started this website so that we could have access to a lot of things, including providing some of my music and my Instagram account, which is a new thing for me. And it's been super active, and it coincides with the release of the guitar and everything, and we kind of had to do it. But it's been a fascinating couple of weeks, getting lots of activity and interest on that account, and lovely comments from people that are happy to know that I'm still alive and still doing things.
Well, I wasn't aware you had an Instagram, so I'm glad you said it, and we'll let our audience know so they follow you. Is it just your name? Is it at Alex Lifeson?
It's The Real Lurkst.
Oh, okay. Let me guess. Somebody had Alex Lifeson and wanted $1 million to give it to you.
Probably. I didn't bother looking into that, but the Real Lurkst works fine because all I right. am The Real Lurkst.
Yes. Well, we will definitely look that up, and I'll be sure to follow you. And it's never too late to dive into the wacky world of social media, Alex.
Oh, I guess.
Yeah. If you want to look at the comments, you have to have a thick skin, but otherwise you can just have some fun and post on it. But I would think the vast majority of people following you, it's nothing but love, as it should be. Hey, let me ask you about, you know, the last few years, about your health. Now, you mentioned the R40 tour, and I know at that time we had done an interview, and you'd done an interview with Rolling Stone, and you had mentioned you were dealing with some issues with arthritis. You talked about some medication that was helping you. I know that at times it may have impacted your playing a little bit on the last tour. How are you now? How is your health now with that, and overall, how do you feel?
You know, I miss working out. I kind of have not followed my regimen like I normally would, which is, you know, working out a few days a week with a trainer. I love it because I hate it and I don't want to do it, but because he's there, I got to go. And as soon as that was over with the pandemic, I was like, okay, great. I'll see him next time. And I really, really missed that. You know, I play golf, and tennis was off limits until recently. In terms of my general health, I mean, my health is great. Yeah, I have, you know, psoriatic arthritis. I've had it for many, many years. And I'm really fortunate. I started taking care of it early on, and a lot of the medication available for sufferers of arthritis have really come a long way in the last years. These biologics work incredibly well, and I'm on two particular ones. So they work great. They really help my fingers a lot. I don't have any complaints or any issues. Once in a while, there's some inflammation and it's a little harder, but it works out. And so long as I keep moving and active, it's not bad at all. And compared to some people, it's nothing. I'm fine. I don't even really think about it. So
That's great to hear, because, you know, you hear all sorts of things from guitar players and these musicians that we know and love as they get older. Today alone, yep. Frank Marino, a Canadian guitar player who's quite legendary, yep. announced he's not going to be able to tour for undisclosed medical issues. So you it's great to hear some positive news about health, because we're all getting older and we all have to watch it and take care of ourselves. But especially you being a guitar player, that, you know, having some issues with your hands or wrists or fingers obviously could be, you know, a scary thing, I would think.
Yeah, it is a little bit, but at the same time, I find that, you know, your brain is a powerful thing. Sometimes it's a stupid thing, but generally it's pretty powerful, and you can work around these sort of issues. I just tell myself it's nothing, and I can trick myself that way. I'm easily tricked, in fact. So it's really not bad at all.
You talk about the workaround. Last thing on this, I was a few years ago, I had the honor of touring with Deep Purple and hosting their shows, and we went through Mexico together. And Steve Morse, who's been their guitar player for like 20 years, I was watching him. I was in the dressing room pre-show, and what he was doing to his hands and his wrists and the way he was taping and putting lotion, and he's telling me of all these issues he has, and that now Steve has completely changed the way he plays guitar, the way he actually holds chords and fingers things, because he physically can't do it that way anymore. So there are, I guess, and I'm not a musician, but I guess there are workarounds that maybe in some ways even reinvent your playing to a degree, that you are kind of forced to do as you get older, whether it's drummers notoriously have issues with joints and shoulders or whatever, or guitar players, it's not uncommon.
Yeah, no, I guess it's not. But, you know, everybody deals with it in a different way. For Steve, you know, that guy played all the time. I remember when we were working together, we'd show up for sound check at 4 o'clock, and he'd already be at the venue walking around the building just playing his guitar. He must have played for hours and hours and hours before doing the show on any given night. The guy was so disciplined, and I really admired that. I wish I could have done the same thing. But maybe it's a good thing, because my fingers aren't so bad and his are. So I win.
Alex, how's the reaction been to, people were so excited to get Cobble Blues and Spy House a week or so ago, just because not only are they wonderful songs, but it just showed people that, you know, the Rush fans, you know, the world is just dying for stuff from you and Getty at this point, individually, together, whatever it may be. So it just felt great to have something new to talk about from Alex Lifeson. The response to the songs, now that they've been out there for a little bit, what have you been hearing from fans?
Very, very positive. You know, they're quirky songs. Cobble Blues started out as a blues song. You know, they're all exercises for me. And I generally do these things just to keep my chops and keep active and keep active as a songwriter as well. So I started out as, you know, I thought, I'd like to do something bluesy today. So I put down a drum pattern, and then I started manipulating the drum pattern so it was a little quirkier. And then I think I started playing a solo over, like a bluesy solo over that beginning, and then building all the other stuff. And then it took this Eastern kind of turn, and there was that element of it, hence the name Cobble Blues. Once I sort of got this arrangement in shape, I looked at the background and I thought that it would be so cool to make this deep and mysterious and dark, and start doing all kinds of trippy psychedelic stuff, lots of backwards guitar and little quirky things that run off, and that was really a wonderful creative exercise, creating a lot of those sounds, because most of them, you know, there are a couple of sampled sounds here and there, but most of them I created myself just by getting in the right mood, and then fooling around with all the technical stuff to create those colorings and atmospherics and shading, and the combination of those three approaches, I think it really works in an interesting Alex Lifeson sort of way.
And Spy House, same sort of thing?
Spy House was the same sort of thing. Again, it was just, you know, what can I do with this simple riff, and how can I make it more interesting? And, you know, it started out as it does, and then it goes into this, you know, sort of glorious chorus of orchestrated parts. And again, it was just building and layering and throwing on some vocal samples. And then a typical solo that you don't hear very much anymore these days. So then it's only, 2 minutes long or 2.5 minutes long. So it was a really fun little exercise to do that one. All of these songs are going to be included in the Envy of None project. And Maya has already done a vocal for Cabo Blues, which is really, really cool. And she's got some ideas for a couple of the other songs. So just waiting for those as we're mixing them now as well.
So this news came out, I guess, a day or two ago in an interview. Envy of None is going to be, just for clarity, is Envy of None a new band? Is it a project? Is it the name of an Alex Lifeson solo record? Fill the fans in on exactly what Envy of None, which is a great name, by the way. You know, I mean, not something anybody wants to be, but it's kind of funny. Tell me about Envy of None and exactly what it is.
So it's a project, really. It started out with Andy Curran. Andy played in a band called Coney Hatch. They were a popular Canadian band in the 80s and 90s, and they had some success. And he worked at Anthem Records for many years as our A&R guy there. So we have a long history with Andy. And when we came off the road in 2015, Andy was working on some stuff on his own. He was looking to get some music on, you know, placements for TV and film. And he reached out and asked if I would play some guitar stuff on some of the things that he'd written. And they were all just rough demos at the time. And I love doing that sort of thing. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And I did, you know, worked on a song and didn't hear anything for a while. And then I heard from him and he said, you know, I got another song if you don't mind. And sure, I'll do that. And I did that. And we had another singer that was a female singer that was on the early versions of a couple of those songs. And then he came across Maya and they decided to do some work together. And then that started growing and he introduced me to Maya. And then I used Maya for a project that I did with Marco Miniman a couple of years ago for a song called Lover's Calling. And she did a fantastic job on that. Her voice is very soft, delicate, fragile, but she's very bright. Her lyrics are very, very thoughtful and great imagery. And that contrasted so well to the kind of music that we were writing together. And even though it started out casually and we were using plugins and not taking it too very seriously, it all changed when Maya came along and then we started really building the tracks. Alf Annabellini is also involved. And Alf is he's a guitar player and also an engineer at Metalworks and he teaches engineering arts. So with the four of us, we shared files. It started moving around. Then we started updating the files and getting a little more serious about how we were recording. And then more songs started to develop. And so now, well, I guess about 4 years later, after the very beginning, we're in the final mix stages. We have a couple of things that we're waiting for Maya lyrically or vocally to just drop into the mixes, and then we're set to go. So hopefully, I don't know, I was going to say later this summer, but more likely sometime in the fall, we should have everything done. It's 10 songs. We want to release it as an album. It's very challenging these days. I didn't realize the record industry was gone and has been replaced by something I don't recognize at all. So we're trying to determine how we're going to move forward on this. We have the interest of a couple of companies that would like to have a listen and see if there's something that they could do. But at one way or another, we'd like to get this music out before the end of this year. And I'm really, really excited about it. It's really quite different. A lot of it is dark and menacing. Some of it is poppy, but in a very cool sort of hip way. Some is countryish. Some is ballady, but it's not, I don't know, it's not in a very kind of traditional way. There's some really great stuff. And I was very, very experimental with a lot of the guitar sounds that I did, trying to create textures and atmospherics that are not guitar centric. I mean, there's lots of guitar playing on it, but it's always so much fun for me to try to create sounds and tones and colorings with the guitar without it sounding like a guitar.
Mm. So Alex, you're talking about putting out this new music, and again, it's called Envy of None. There will be an album, as you said, coming towards the end of the year. And you made a comment about not recognizing the music industry and what it is now. And I've, you know, a lot of my friends that are in the business as well, who have been in for a very long time like you, have the same sentiment. It's kind of hard to process what it is now. The one underlying thing that people take away is where it's at is live. Like, if you don't go out on the road and play to promote and support something, you're going to sell the first couple days to your hardcore base, and then it's pretty much going to go off the radar. So to that end, when this comes out, do you have a desire to go out and play live with this band that you're assembling?
That's a good question. To be honest with you, I don't think so. We've talked a little bit about it, but we don't want to, you know, get too far ahead of what we really need to do, and that's concentrate on finishing the record and getting it out. Maya is a lot younger than any of us are. She's in her early mid 20s, and she would love to take this out on the road and do a proper tour. And you know, it all depends on how it goes. If there's a good response, then maybe we'll look at it. And I would probably at least consider a handful of shows. I'm not saying that we are, but at that time, I would think about it anyways, if it was limited to something like that. But frankly, after 40 years of touring and half a dozen years before that, playing bars and living in crappy hotels, room and small hotel bars and all of that, I don't have much of a desire to be sitting in a hotel room staring at the TV, you know, for 22 hours of the day for the 2 hours of excitement. And I don't really miss the live experience. I've done it a few times since in smaller venues, smaller projects, some mostly charity stuff. And it's fun, you know, when it's for a couple hundred people, and I don't mind. But to do the whole big production, I'm not so sure. I'm very lazy by nature. I don't know if I'd want to, you know, dive into that again.
So, you know, it's interesting about that. When R40 happened, and I've said this many, many times, to me, there's no band that ended on a better note and ended in a better way than Rush. And I'm not saying that because you're just sitting here. I've said that repeatedly. I see so many bands that, in my opinion, stay too long at the party. When they finally do play their final tour, it's a shell of what the band was. Maybe there's one original guy. We see it too much. With Rush, it couldn't have been more different. I went to the show in Denver. I remember I interviewed you there. The set, the way it was constructed, the way the band sounded was just incredible. What's interesting about what you're saying is that being the final tour, largely attributed to, at the time, Neil not wanting to continue. But it sounds like, and I've never heard your take on this, maybe around that point, you were kind of okay with it winding down as well. If you were at that point somewhat fatigued by touring, that you were kind of okay also with that being the last tour, as it turned out to be?
Well, you know, we were... in our early 60s, when that tour ended, after the number of dates that we did do, which was about half of what we would normally do, we were all starting to feel the fatigue as you normally would. And we would, had it been a normal tour, we would have gone out for probably another month and then taken a month off, then picked it up, or maybe a couple months off, and then picked it up for another 3 or 4 months. I personally, and I think the same for Ged, we were really excited about the show, the presentation of the show, the whole concept of, you know, going back through our history. I thought we were all playing really, really well. And I probably could have continued to do another 30 shows. And I think Getty felt the same way, but it was becoming really difficult for Neil to play at that level. And unless he could play 100% at that level, he really didn't want to do any more shows. And he didn't want to be that person that should have, you know, taken it. And it was hard for him. 3 hour show playing the way he played. It's a miracle that he was even able to play. And he had some issues through that tour. You know, he had an infection in his feet and he could barely walk, never mind, you know, playing a bass drum the way he did, and never complained or anything like that. So it was time. And in retrospect, it couldn't have been better because we were playing great. And we finished on such a high note. Fans were so happy. I mean, with the performance, all things were right. That was the great way to ensure our legacy and be remembered for those guys, for being that band that played that way. I honestly would hate to be working now, for example, and not being able to play a song because my fingers are just killing me and not playing as well and making all those mistakes. I made enough mistakes, but now way too many. So all in all, it really turned out to be the opportune time for us to end a long career. You know, not a lot of bands lasted 40 years of that regular touring and many, many, many albums and all of that stuff. So
and the same guys had to come. And the same guys, that's unprecedented. So that's remarkable as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it truly is. You know what's funny is you're talking about like how you're fine with not being on the road. So when Getty was on with me for the book a couple times, I had asked him what he had been up to. And he said to me that he had been doing a lot of traveling. And I said, my God, after like 50 years traveling, are you insane? Like, I would think I'd want to be like you in your bunker there, just like shutting the world out. And he said, no, he said, the difference is obviously when we traveled for Rush, it was get to the gig, get to the hotel, get to the gig. He said, now I'm enjoying taking photos and being with my wife and spending time in the cities and getting out there. So, and then when he put it in that perspective, I understood what he was talking about. So do you travel in that way now? Have you been able to do things with your family and take advantage of some stuff in recent years that normally after dedicating your life to Rush, you wouldn't be able to do?
Somewhat, not to the extent that he does. I really admire Getty for the way he does travel now. Quite often he'll do a trip for a month and he'll pick some locations that they'll go to. And he really, it's, you know, he really gets everything he can out of it. He's a birder. So he enjoys photographing birds and he's a history buff and, you know, he really makes the most out of those trips that he does. We don't travel to that extent. I did a trip, you know, certainly for the last year and a half, we haven't been traveling at all. But prior to that, we did a trip to Italy. And I've been to Italy a bunch of times. But what was nice about this trip is my wife and I went with our two sons and their partners. And we spent a week, but it was a whirlwind trip. And we really packed a lot of great stuff into it. And the fact that it was family and an adult family, because my kids are very grown up, boy, I'll never forget that. We, you know, lots of great photographs, but the memories I have from the nights and the meals and the things that we saw and the experiences we had, it was really, really indelible. I'll remember it forever.
Before I run out of time with you, let me ask you about this guitar, because you have a new Epiphone that is coming out. Tell everybody about the new signature guitar that is it released or about to be released? Give us the details about it.
Yeah, no, it was released a couple of weeks ago. In 2011, I designed or co-designed a Gibson guitar that, you know, they wanted me to do a signature series, and it's easy to put your name on it and just stick it out there and you sell it because it's got your name on it. But if we were going to do a signature guitar, I really wanted it to be a guitar that I would want to buy. And we spent quite a bit of time, about 2 years, creating this guitar with all the features that I wanted on it, which, you know, included a vibrato arm and a piezo pickup so that I could get an acoustic guitar sound, coil splitters to you know, clean up the sound, make it a little thinner, just really lots of variety. And now, 10 years later, Epiphone wanted to release that same guitar on the Epiphone platform. So a much more a different price point, easier access for beginners particularly. And I think they hit it out of the park. This guitar is beautiful. It feels great. All those features are there. It works great. And my understanding is they sold out the first production run in 2 weeks, and they're scrambling to ramp up for the next production run. So all things great with that. And I had fun doing an ad for it. You know, I didn't want to do something with an ad company and slick and all of that stuff. So basically I just wrote copy out about my history with the guitar and what it meant to me growing up to have a good guitar, and especially a Gibson that I'd always admired, and added some photographs on, you know, Final Cut and some video. And then we had an editor smooth everything out and make it look real. But I love the fact that it was my creation, and we got a team together to do it from my end. And it was very down to earth and very much like me. And I wanted it to be sort of a casual conversation with the listener, and it worked out great. And I think it's really quite unique for anything that Gibson does. You know, they have some beautiful slick ads, but this was something a little more organic, and I think it's worked out great.
What was your
the songs? Those, you know, that also gave me a place to put Kabul Blues and Spy House in the background with all this stuff. And then Gibson wanted to re-release those songs in their full versions. So that led to where we are today.
Alex, what was your very, very first guitar? How old were you when you got it? And do you still have it?
I don't have it. It was a Kent acoustic guitar. It was $10. My parents bought it for me 1 year for Christmas, I think in 1966. And I had that guitar for a year. And it was so hard to play. The action was very high on it. But I did. Every day I played it. And I asked them for an electric guitar the following year for Christmas. And I got a Kenora, which was originally made in Japan for a Canadian distributor. And it was a very inexpensive guitar as well. I think it was $59. It was a semi-acoustic, and it didn't sound particularly great, but I still have it. I'm restoring it actually. Wow. Now to bring it back to its former glory. Like, you know, Getty and I, he had a Kenora bass. We painted our guitars. We were so inspired by Jack Bruce and Eric Clapton and their beautiful instruments that were painted in that period in the 60s. So we thought we would do our own. So we painted them Day-Glo green and orange and purple, and stuck all kinds of fluorescent tape and things on it. It looked ridiculous, but they were totally cool. And now we've just taken it right down to the wood, and I'm going to get the finish back to the way it was. So,
you know, can you tell us like what your relationship like is now with Getty? Because obviously you've been partners in this thing for so many decades, and now obviously he's doing some things on his own. You're doing some things on your own. As you know, there's a large segment of your fan base that would love to see at some point you guys do something together in some way, shape, or form. But I also would imagine after working with any musical partner for as many decades as you did, it's kind of liberating and fun to be able to do something outside of the expected confines of what you would do with that person or the umbrella of Rush. So I can see it kind of cutting both ways. I'm sure you could appreciate the fans being like, well, we need something together. But then at the same token, if you take a step back from it, if you've been doing that for your whole life, to be able to all of a sudden say, hey, well, I can do something a little experimental or something that maybe that wouldn't fit under the Rush umbrella, that it's as a musician, that's got to be really feel great to be able to do. So if you can address that a little bit as far as that balance of trying to keep the Rush fans happy and maybe at some point, if you feel it, collaborate with Get again versus doing things with Andy and other folks to just express a different side of your musical creativity.
Well, this whole project, this whole Envy of None project started out very organically. It was just a casual little thing, helping a friend out. And then it developed into something else and became more serious. And it is immensely gratifying and satisfying for me as a musician and a songwriter to work in this context, because there is total freedom. I get to pursue the kind of sounds that I think are applicable to the material. So it's a whole different mental exercise for me working on this material. Getty and I started writing together when we were, I don't know, 14 years old, I guess. And we are best friends. And I love the guy so much. He's, you know, means so much to me. And we've had this amazing experience of working together as well as being buddies. I talk to Ged, you know, every couple of days or so. We try to get together for dinner. That's been a more challenging thing lately, but we did get out once recently, and it's great because mostly we're pals. And if there's something that comes up in the future, an opportunity for us to do something, we'll decide over a cup of coffee what that'll be. But there's no urgency, or there's no pre-planned thing now. He's doing whatever he's doing. I'm doing whatever I'm doing. And we keep each other informed and stuff like that. But God, we had such a great history and did so much great stuff together. It's not really a big deal if for the rest of our lives, we're just best friends, you know? I know Rush fans are a unique bunch, and I love them. And certainly everything that we've done, we've always done to satisfy ourselves before anybody else. And I think Rush fans understood that. And we're always very supportive, very critical at times too, but always supportive. And that was the nature of our relationship with our fans. It was a really good two-way relationship. But I think really Rush ended in 2015. There's no way Rush will ever exist again because Neil's not here to be a part of it. And that's not to say that we can't do other things and we can't do things that benefit our communities and all of that. I have lots of plans for that sort of thing that don't, you know, necessarily include Getty. So, you know, I get asked this all the time. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Who knows? All I know is we still love each other and we're still very, very good friends. And we always will be.
Yeah. Well, and that's extremely important. Okay. Tough question for you, Alex. You got a favorite Rush album? After some time has passed and you look back on the catalog, is there one for you that if somebody listening to this right now never heard of Rush, some young kid, like who's this guy Eddie Trunk talking to this guy Alex Lifeson about this band Rush that he was in? Where do you send them?
Are you a family man? Do you have kids?
Yes.
Who's your favorite kid?
Good one.
That's what it's like. You know, if I look back at all our records, there are things that I really love about some of them. There are things that I think we could have done better. There are things that irritate me. It's just like having a kid. You know, if I had to pick a record that I would say for a non-listener to introduce themselves to Rush, it would probably be Moving Pictures, because there's something about that record that's indescribable. It's the energy on it and the way it feels and the way those songs all developed and the cool stories that they became. It's a very cinematic record. Certainly, Grace Under Pressure was such a difficult record. If I was talking about that to somebody who'd never heard us, I would explain what we went through, the hard times, the tough being in the studio, working every single day for 4 months, and the weather was awful, and their co-producer was not what we expected, and the workload was terrible. But it's all part of that growing process, and that leads to this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. Same with Vapor Trails. That's such a dark, sorrowful period in our history, yet the experience of making that record and those songs and how difficult it all was, you know, that it leaves scars, but they're scars that you end up being proud of. By far, Moving Pictures was the easiest, most satisfying, fun record we ever made. But that's not the criteria for why you love a piece of music. I think the harder stuff resonates with you as a writer more than anything. And I got to say, Clockwork Angels, it came such a long way in that period and represented so many things to us. And now in retrospect, being the last album, that song, The Garden, being the last song, it's the most appropriate last song for a last record that anybody could ever think of. So it all seems like it fell into place in a nice way for us.
Well, Nick Raskulinitz is a regular listener of this radio show, so I'm sure he's listening right now and probably loves that you just said that. I'm going to get a text from him any second saying, go, Alex. I was glad that was in there. And final thing, Alex, and I appreciate your time. You know, a lot of my audience calls and asks me about this. A few years ago, it was announced in Canada that Neil's family was going to have a tribute show for him there. And that seems to have been derailed because of COVID. Were you involved in that in any way? And is that something you'd like to see happen in any way?
Oh, I think that was a thing between the family, and they had their own plans and we had our own plans. And of course, when the pandemic started, it was right around the time that we were planning all these things. So it's put all those plans on the back burner, and really until we are completely open, we don't really know what the situation is with that. So we'll just remain open to it.
Okay, cool. Well, I got to tell you, it's wonderful to see you. It's wonderful to hear you. And it's wonderful to hear you making music. I mean, I know I speak for all the fans. Hearing you play guitar again is a wonderful thing. I hope we get some live. I mean, I'd love to see you even in a small place. It'd be, you know, Andy is an old friend, Andy Curran, and I loved Coney Hatch. Unfortunately, they didn't make it here in America. But, you know, they're still around. They did a stream recently that I helped them out with. And I love Andy to death, and I know he's worked with you for a long time, so I think it's great you're working with him. And I can't wait to see where this all goes, and I know Andy will be goosing you to get out there and play some shows. If I know Andy, he'd probably love to hit the road a little bit. So hopefully we get that opportunity. You know, and I just was thinking, too, speaking on the Rush side of things, the reissues of the catalog have been fantastic. Have you enjoyed doing, you know, those reissues? Have you been actively involved in them, or you just let the label do that? But I thought they've been great.
Yeah, it's a label thing. We don't really have a lot to do with it. We are asked for approvals out of courtesy from the record company, but you know, it's really up to them what they want to do with that stuff. However, they've done a great job. I know Moving Pictures, there's big plans for that, for this 40th anniversary. So yeah, look out for that one. That'll be a good one.
Got to get a 25th anniversary on the Victor record to come out too. I can't believe that's 25 years. That's nuts.
I know. It goes so fast.
It's crazy. Well, Alex, I could talk to you forever. I appreciate you being so generous with your time. And again, everybody check out the Epiphone guitar Les Paul Standard Access that's out there right now. You can hear Cobble Blues and Spy House Now on Alex's website. As he mentioned, he's on Instagram as well, so hit him up on social media. And I can't wait to see what the future holds. Alex, thank you so much for the time. Great to visit with you.
My pleasure, Eddie. Take care. See you soon.
See ya. Thank you so much. Thanks to Alex Lifeson. Great to visit with him. By the way, if you are a SiriusXM subscriber, and if you're listening in the U.S. or Canada, I certainly hope you are, You can see video of that conversation. It was all captured over Zoom, and that is available on the SiriusXM app. So you can watch what you just heard if you'd like. Coming up next, we stay in Canada and speak with Mike Levine of Triumph.
Hey there. I host a show called Therapy Gecko, where I dress up as a lizard and talk to anonymous strangers from the internet about their lives. They tell me their relationship problems.
I found out that I was related to the guy that I was dating.
Their hobbies.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
Their secrets.
When we did not have toilet paper, I would use the shower curtain.
And also sometimes kind of serious stuff.
I have anxiety when I talk to people.
I'm also sometimes joined by celebrity guests like Doja Cat, Lil Yachty, Bobby Lee, and Eric Andre. Some of the more interesting calls we've gotten recently include a guy who argued with a demon living on his wall, a caller drunk at his job at a middle school, and a caller wondering whether or not he should transform into a dog. So if you're sick of your own life and you want to get lost in the life of a stranger, search for Therapy Gecko wherever you get your podcasts.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Welcome back. Eddie Trunk here with you on this week's podcast. We continue our Canadian doubleheader. Mike Levine, bass player of the band Triumph, another great Toronto Canadian trio. He joins us right now to talk about the 40th anniversary of the band's Allied Forces album, as well as the upcoming Triumph documentary. Here's Mike Levine. We're going to take a second here to welcome our guest to kick off hour number two of Trunk Nation here on SiriusXM Volume. He is the bass player from the band Triumph, an old friend, and it's always great to speak with him for a bit. It is Mike Levine joining us right now. Mike, what's going on, man?
Hey, Eddie. Trying to survive the heat up here in Toronto. How's it down there?
It's pretty sticky and warm in New Jersey at the moment. You have a – when I talked to you last, I know you do in the winter, you have a place, is it in Jamaica?
Yeah, that's right.
Did you spend the winter there again?
Yeah, we spent a little less time than usual, but we're worried about getting back in the country with all the border restrictions, all that BS, you know. So we ended up flying into Buffalo and driving across the border rather than flying to Toronto.
How's things in Toronto now, Mike, as far as are things loosening, getting better there? Here in the U.S., we're pretty much wide open most places. How are things there?
Here, we're just starting, certainly in our province of Ontario, where Toronto is. As of Friday, we go into from total lockdown into stage one recovery, so to speak. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, one from column A, two from column B. None of it makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Oh, I've been saying that all along. This through this whole thing, the mixed messaging across the board has been maddening and just absolutely crazy. Have you been able to get the vaccine, Mike?
Yeah, actually, I got my two doses. My wife and I are double dose now, which is great.
Good.
That happened Sunday morning. We got our second dose. So that was, you know, I wish everybody just went for it. It just makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, here we're not even, we don't even have a mask mandate anymore. It's, you know, it's wonderful. It feels great. So hopefully you guys will get there sooner than later. So, hey, Mike, yeah. Before we talk about Allied Forces in this reissue and what you got going on, I got to ask you this because I'm really excited and chomping at the bit to see the Triumph documentary, and I haven't heard much about it or its release. What is the latest on that?
Oh, let's see now. The latest is, a couple of weeks ago, I went in the studio with the film guys to work on the audio portion of the soundtrack, basically, and to approve stuff, and which I did, and then promptly left and let them do their work. And I think they're in the process now of laying in the credits, and then it's finished. I hope. But this, you know, COVID, it's been, you know, not only deadly, but it's certainly been, you know, delayed everything because it's really hard to work. You know, Bagger Films was shut down. Everybody was working from home, which is hard to do when you're editing film and that, you know. So we're just hoping that it'll be done. One of these days we'll get a message saying, okay, go look at it. Here's a link.
Yeah, see, I figured, and I had assumed, and of course I don't know anything about filmmaking, but I had assumed that, because I know that I was interviewed for it a while ago, and I know most of the interviews were done a while ago, pre-COVID, so I had figured that during COVID would have been a great time that they could have just hunkered down in an edit bay somewhere and put it all together, but I guess it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, the editor was working from home. You know, took all his gear out of the edit base at Banger, and then he would have to upload it to Sam Dunn, the co-director. That took hours on the internet, and then Sam would look at it and send his corrections back, and they talk on the phone. And it was like, what would take, you know, a half hour at the edit bay with the two guys together took like 3 days, you know, to accomplish. So, they're back at work, which is good, and hopefully that, again, everything was pretty much done. It's just bits and pieces and putting in new pictures that had placeholders, as they call them, that kind of thing. So I'm praying we're done, and we'll see the light of day in the fall. And hopefully theaters will come back to a decent capacity. That's what we're looking forward to.
Are you happy with what you've seen of it so far, of the footage you have seen and how it's come together? Are you pleased with what you've seen?
I love it. I think it's absolutely a great story of the Triumph journey. You know, it's not just a bunch of interviews with the band and, you know how we did this or, you know, whether we got along or not. It's really tells a great story, and it'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. You know, so it's kind of all encompassing, and that's why I like it. It's, you know, like I enjoyed watching it. Usually I'd go, oh boy, that really stinks, or I hate that scene, but you know, nothing's perfect, of course. And, but the folks that have seen it, are in love with it. They just think it's fantastic. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great.
That's how it'll be received out there.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to see it. I love music. I love documentaries, especially music and rock documentaries. And I thought it was great that Sam and the crew picked you guys to do as a subject for their next one. And I am very much anticipating seeing it. So, of course, when it's out and people can watch it and I can see it, we'll do some stuff around that for sure. So it blows my mind, all these anniversaries of these records coming up that still feel very new to me or not nearly as old as they are. It seems like every day we're doing something on a 30th or a 40th anniversary of what is probably my favorite Triumph record, and that is Allied Forces. And I know you are celebrating that with a super deluxe package. Talk a little bit about what you've put together for this.
Yeah, you know, the Record Store Day people came to us a year ago up here in Canada and asked us to be quote-unquote ambassadors for Record Store Day. Now, we had no idea of really anything about Record Store Day or being an ambassador. But at the end of the day, it's really just lending our name to the event itself. And, of course, we all grew up, you know, going to, you know, record stores and flipping through vinyl and looking for records to buy. And so we thought it would be a good idea for us to do it. And then it'd be like, okay, we need a piece of product to go along with it. One of the bright boys in the band, I think it was probably me, said, hey, why don't we do a 40th anniversary box set of Allied Forces, because we've never done a box set. Not thinking about how much work it is to put one together. So it was a long effort. You know, it took, I guess they started in November, I want to say, or October, and it wasn't finished until 3 weeks ago. So the good news, Eddie, was that I don't know if you're familiar with a band called Coney Hatch from Canada.
Yes. Oh, my God. I love Coney Hatch. Yeah.
Okay. So Andy Curran is a bass player in Coney Hatch. And
good
Andy
friend.
Worked for, he worked for Rush for a long time and was instrumental in putting together their box set. So we convinced the record company to hire Andy to put it together, which was the best move we ever made in the world, because Andy not only is a fantastic guy and a good friend, but he's a big fan, and he was willing to roll up his sleeves and get his hands dirty. And he went up at the Attic at Metalworks, Eddie, and he'd come down and he'd be sweating and he'd be filthy dirty, but he had shots of all this memorabilia that's stored up there that we had no idea we had. So Andy was like beside himself excited, and we were excited along with him. But honestly, he did 90% of the work. All we had to do was approve it or say, you know, yay or nay on things. So I got to see it 2 weeks ago for the first time, and I think it's absolutely fabulous. It is a first-class package. No cheap out, no record company BS around it, you know. It is absolutely sensational.
So in this box set, there is a bunch of stuff, as you mentioned. Andy probably sourced all this stuff, photos, tour posters, handwritten lyric sheets. I'm looking at the rundown of all the stuff. Of course, the album on vinyl. And then I think one of the real interesting things is there is a full live show from the Allied Forces tour, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was from Cleveland.
And that has never been released. I was sent a link to hear some of that. That never came out before, right?
No, not on vinyl. It may have been out on it's partially an old King Biscuit Flower Hour recording.
Okay,
had mixed and it was a radio show, right? So it was pretty amazing. You know, Andy and I did some work on it, and we were both going, "Wow, Triumph was really hot that night." So. It came out good. It sounds great on vinyl. The low end is spectacular, just because I'm the bass player. But Andy and I agreed on that part.
Well, you know, I was just gonna say that, Mike. You just said you and Andy worked on the audio. It just a heads up to the audience. Andy's also a bass player, so I guarantee you the bottom end sounds real good with the two of you guys digging in.
Yeah, it's a nice looking package. It's a gatefold. It's a double album. It's on 180 gram vinyl. I think it sounds spectacular myself, but again, I'm prejudiced. But again, those who have heard it say, "Wow, this is really cool."
Now I got a little bone to pick with you. Now, nothing Uh-oh. Against the people that are on the vinyl kick and that are into vinyl. And of course, I grew up with vinyl. I grew up working in a record store. I just love people connecting with music physically. But Mike, I am still to my core a lover, defender, player, buyer of CDs. You did not do a CD version of this, Mike?
Nope.
Oh, you're did killing not. Me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Andy. If I would have known, we would have done one.
Just for me.
Just for you.
Mike, can you talk? I'm going to send Andy a note and beat him up on it, and maybe the two of you could take 5 minutes and just go on your computer and whip together a version just for me on CD, because that's still my way to listen to music. But I understand Record Store Day, want people on this vinyl resurgence. It's wonderful. But I am a defender of CDs to my core, and I was thought, you know, most of the times there's the CD version, or at least they throw a CD in the box with all the other stuff, but no digital version available of this yet.
No, we went whole hog 80s here, you know.
So. No, 70s, really.
70s, I guess, yeah, you're right.
Well, you could do the 41st anniversary on CD for me. There you go.
We'll figure something out for you, Eddie, I promise.
Mike, what is, you know, I mentioned when we started talking that Allied Forces is probably my favorite Triumph record. Where does it stand for you in the catalog? How do you feel about it revisiting it 40 years ago?
Well, you know, it's interesting because every album was my favorite album at one point. You know, you finish an album and it's your favorite album. Then you go on to the next one, the next one's your favorite album. So I would say overall, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think Allied Forces was just, you know, when I think back and doing interviews around it, it was a comfortable album to make. In other words, we're first time at working in Metalworks, our own studio. So we had we're beneficiaries of that from a time point of view. Didn't have the clock going and the money going out the door to somebody else for studio time. So we were able to, you know, relax, take our time, you know, write in the studio, do a demo, and go, wow, that's a piece of garbage, or wow, that's something we really have to pursue. We are onto something there. So from that point of view, just the fun we had making the record, no real bad headaches about it. You know, we didn't fight about anything. And then the acceptance of the record, you know, radio was all over it, as you know, and the fans loved it. And, you know, it spawned a couple of evergreen songs for us that are still on the radio today, you know. So a long answer to a short question, yes, it's probably my favorite album.
You know, just looking at the arc of the band, so I remember my first Triumph album that I purchased when it was new was the previous record, Progressions of Power, and that was the first time, at least in my area of the U.S., that I started to hear Triumph on the radio a little bit with a song on that album called I Can Survive. And I love Progressions of Power as well. And then Allied Forces comes, and to me, it was Progressions of Power taken a step further. And the thing that at the time still, and it's still sonically an amazing sounding record, Allied Forces, the drums are so big on it. It's such a big sounding record. In addition to the material, that was the thing that I thought was such another step forward for Triumph at the time. So talk about that aspect of it a little bit. Did that come down to the fact that that Allied Forces was the first record you made in your own studio?
Yeah, for sure. Because we had there was the opportunity to play around. Like, we had to get used to the room. And for me, as producer, you know, I had to get used to the monitors and the sound. But what we did do with the drums, because there's an empty warehouse next door to where the studio was that we had. So we set the drums up in there and mic'd them. And so it gave the drums this bigness, you know, the ambience of almost playing at a hockey rink, you know. But you were able to control. It was controllable. It wasn't out of control. So as you added a guitar track or the bass went on, or a vocal even, it ate up some of the space that the drums were taking. So they sounded big, but not to the point where they, I would say, irritating even, you know, which could have happened very easily. So that sure was a big step forward for us. Like the bigness, like I said, with my buddy Andy, Low End was where it was at on that record too. And Vinyl, you know, it was tough to jam the Low End on, but the warmth of the Low End on Vinyl was, you know, incredible. I you know, even on CD, Eddie, no matter what you say, if you an Allied Forces record on CD and on Vinyl, you're going to love the Vinyl a lot better. May not be as convenient, but you're going to love it better.
Can't I just turn up the bass on my stereo? That's what that bass knob is for, Mike.
No, what was that button that used to be on there? The loudness button, right?
I forgot about the loudness button, but of course, at one point, I had the big equalizer rack. It's what's funny is like all these records that get remastered or whatever, I was like, oh, you could do that yourself, man. You just plug in one of those EQ things in your stereo. You got like 20 sliders, and you can have a field day making it however you want to make it. Hey, let me ask you about the song Magic Power, because to my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm only speaking from a U.S. perspective, you guys being a Canadian band, it could have been very different, but to my recollection, Magic Power from Allied Forces was the biggest U.S. radio song you had had up to that point. Would that be accurate?
Not really. You know, I think when you go back to the Just a Game album and you look at Lay It on the Line, for example, like Hold On did very well. You know, it charted top 40 and did really well at album radio. But Lay It on the Line really busted the band at album radio, at rock radio. Mm-hmm. Not a top 40, but because we didn't care about top 40, it made no difference to us. But that was the song that really put us on the map with radio, and in 79. So when Magic Power comes along, of course, it's kind of similar to Lay It on the Line in some ways. Right? It's got that kind of quiet intro, you know, with the 12-string guitar. And Rick singing, and it's a different song, obviously, different tempo and everything else. But there was a similarity there, I think, that everybody felt when they heard it. Like, you knew it was Triumph, basically.
Yeah, I mean, for me, maybe it's just the market I lived in, because the other thing about Triumph is, depending upon where you were in the U.S., it was very different in terms of the level of success you had. Like certain parts of Texas, you were way bigger than you may have been, say, in New York back in those days, right?
Yeah, the early days, for sure. You know, and West Coast, we were big. East Coast, you know, in the Northeast, we were big. But New York area, not so big. But upstate New York, we were huge, you know. So it was really weird how that worked. But our success followed our success at radio, pretty much. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how it worked, you know. So if we got airplay, you know, we had bums in seats. Didn't have airplay, we'd still play, but there wouldn't be as many bums in seats.
Yeah, to my recollection, I mean, I certainly, as I went back and got Just a Game and the earlier records and I heard them, I remember Lay It on the Line and all that. But as a kid growing up in the market I did, the first time I heard Triumph was I Can Survive on Progressions of Power. And then when Magic Power hit, it seemed like the things went to a whole nother level in my neck of the woods, so to speak, because that's when the band really came on my radar in a big way with the Allied Forces record. So that being said, what is your take on the previous record, Progressions of Power? Did it do what you wanted it to do? Because that's the record in between the two that we're talking about.
Yeah, we made a little bit, I guess, a little bit of a left or a right turn, you might call it. Just a Game was kind of an experimental record for us, and it was perhaps a little softer overall, a little more progressive at certain times. But you know, Progressions of Power, we decided that, okay, we're going to toughen the band up here. You know, there's songs like I Live for the Weekend and I Can Survive. They're just straight-ahead rockers, you know. And
tear the roof off.
You know, tear the roof off, exactly.
Killer.
You know, so, yeah, it was a killer record. It didn't do as well as Just a Game, which Just a Game almost went platinum, and Progression struggled to go gold. But I think it was because there was a different vibe about the comparison between those two records. There was a different vibe. But I think that if you took a combo of, to your point, if you took a combo of Just a Game and Progressions, put them together, you know, and mixed them up a bit, you came up with Allied Forces.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, you are right about, even though as a kid, Progressions was my first Triumph record, it not doing as well as the record before, the record after. And I can remember, now that you're saying this, I remember this clearly. The reason I got Progressions of Power at the time and my parents bought it for me was because at the time I got it, it was in what was known as the cutout bin, where the overstock records were. So I got Progressions of Power, Mike, as a cutout. But you know, that obviously any artist did not want to be in that bin. But I got to tell you, there were a lot of records that I would get at my local department store and bands I discovered through having records in that bin, because they were cheaper, uh-huh. And it was a way to experiment and find new music without paying full price. And then if you liked it, then you'd get the subsequent records. So as much as the cutout bin is where you don't want to be on a record back then, it actually, there was a silver lining to it now that I think about it.
Right. Well, that's, you know, where when I, you know, frequented record stores on a every day on a weekend when I was growing up, that's where you go first was the delete bin, you know, and anything with a hole punch on it. You know, you look that because it was either a big record that there was overstock or it was a record that didn't do well for whatever reason. But you learned there were some great records that never made it and great artists you never heard of again. And that's kind of where you get the luck of the draw in the music business back then. And I think even today, you know, you got to be good to get lucky, but you got to be lucky to be good, too. So it's a very tough business. Thank God we were kind of in the right place at the right time. And our luck was there, you know,
and
we're
younger
good enough to take advantage of it.
For younger people listening, they have no idea what we're talking about. Back in the day when records came out, if there was too many stocked and it was overstocked and it wasn't selling as much, they would put a hole punch or cut the corner of the jacket off, which would signify that it was a cutout, as they called it, and it would go in a special bin that was usually half the price of a normal record at that time because they just needed to get rid of them. And that's where, like Mike said, and where I went and many others, where you would go if you only had limited funds and you wanted to get a new record, you take a chance. And often I would just make my selection off of what the album cover looked like because that was the only thing you could go according to then.
Well, you're absolutely right. I was going to say that. Like if the album had a great looking cover, you had to buy it. Because somebody obviously thought enough of the band or the artist to put a great cover on it. And you go, the music can't be all that bad with a cover that looks like that. So, that's where I, you know, that was a couple of things that I always look for, you know. And so just to hold the record. God, I miss doing that. You know,
well, you got a hell of a box. You got a hell of a box set people can hold right now with this Allied Forces Super Deluxe coming out. So where do people go, Mike, that are listening that want to order this? Is there a central location? Are you guys selling it directly? Is it in stores? How do they get it?
Well, it's all part of it's a Record Store Day exclusive. So the only stores that have it are independent Record Store Day type stores. And not all of them are going to carry it, obviously, but it's a limited edition run. And, you know, you got to call ahead and make sure they have it. Because, you know, the last thing I want people to do is show up in a store and go, no, we never had that. It's too expensive or we couldn't get it or whatever. But our advice to everybody is to call ahead or check our website. There's a list of all the stores. You can go by area or by area code, and you can check stores. Now, you're still going to have to find out the phone numbers of those stores and whether they have the record. But all of the record stores that participate are there. There's a link to whatever, wherever it goes. I haven't been there, but I'm told it works fine.
All right. Triumphmusic.com is the website. And now I'm getting a Record Store Day. I'm getting a date of June 12th, which is, of course, very soon, and July 17th. So there are two Record Store Days. And is this in Canada and the U.S., both, one or the other? Because we have listeners in both. So for clarity, is this Canada only or America as well?
No, it's both, Canada and America, I guess because of COVID, a lot of projects got delayed that were being done for Record Store Day. So they decided to do two what they call drops. So whatever, you know, there's however many, there might be 100 titles that are Record Store Day type projects that are going to be in stores on the 12th. And then another 100 or 150 or however many will be let out of the cage on the 17th and be in stores then.
Got it. Okay. Triumphmusic.com is where you want to get all your information. 40th anniversary, super deluxe edition of a truly great record, Allied Forces from Triumph. Hard to believe it is 40 years old. Mike, just in wrapping up, documentary then hopefully coming by the end of the year. And, you know, I know, and I've always given you guys credit for this. I've always said that as much as we love bands and wish they'd continue forever, some bands stay too long at the party, need to know when to say when. You guys did that. You knew when to say when, and essentially effectively are retired, but still all friends. But there's no plans for that to change. You don't have plans to play live and do shows or tour at all, right?
No. I mean, you know, we do talk about, you know, if there's a special event of some kind that we can contribute to by playing a song or two, that we'd consider something like that. But as far as doing it, you know, the big tour and all that, it's not in our cards at all, I don't think. We're just a little bit too old, for lack of a better word, to do that.
Well, look, I mean, I give you credit for acknowledging that, because there's nothing worse as a fan of rock music for me than to see bands go out there, as much as you wish they'd go on forever, and be a shell of what they once were, playing to tracks, lip syncing, you know, just a shell, not even real. So that's, I never want that at the expense of continuing, when you should just know when to end. And the legacy of Triumph, just going back and listening to this old stuff, is just incredible. Documentary coming. And I guess most importantly, the three of you are all good friends again, right? You're all on good terms.
Yes, sir. We just actually were together on the weekend to sign some stuff and shoot some video. And all we did was laugh, Eddie. It's like, well, you were with us in Toronto at that when we did that, you know, you saw it. It's like we're nuts. Like, doing an interview with the three of us is almost impossible, because all we do is laugh.
Yeah, that was early on in the history of this particular show. I'm coming up on 40 years doing radio, which is nuts, but this show has existed for about 4 or 5 years on this, and this channel has. And that was in the first year of the existence of this channel volume. And I went to Toronto, and we have a SiriusXM as a studio there. And one day I did a full live show with Bob Ezrin. And the next day, the three of you guys were nice enough to get together and do a full show with me. And I remember we did it at was the studio, but it was like a house somewhere, right?
Right. Yeah. It was on a street called Jarvis Street. I can't remember the name of it even now. But,
yeah.
It's like little studios in a house. I think they did like either TV work or film work or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Usually. Yeah, that was a fun time. And then speaking of Andy Curran, bringing it full circle, that night I went to dinner with Andy, and he picked me up, and we were driving through Toronto, and we passed Massey Hall. And of course, I'm also a Rush fan. And I remember telling Andy, stop. That's where all the World's a Stage was done. And he let me get out of the car and took a photo of me in front of the Massey Hall sign. At the time, I think they were renovating it. Is it still open?
Yeah, it's just about done. I mean, it's been a long project, and the place was kind of falling down. So, you know, a bunch of really good-hearted, music-loving people put up a lot of the dough, because it's taking, you know, I don't know, 15 or 20 million bucks to fix the place up.
Wow.
But, you know, the sad part for us, you know, like growing up in Toronto, you always wanted to play Massey Hall, and we never did play Massey Hall.
Is that right?
Yeah, we had a show book there. It was really our first, you know, legitimate concert in Toronto. It was pretty much sold out, you know, when tickets went on sale. And a couple of weeks later, we get a notice from the fire marshal saying we can't use pyro there. And we went, well, hang on a sec. We played every bar of the city. We played every high school, every college, played some actually quite big shows, but not really, you know, free ones. And we always use pyro. So our first shot is we're not going to use pyro. And we went to CPI, the promoter, and said, we're not playing. Let's move it to Maple Leaf Gardens. And he said, are you crazy? You guys are nuts. But so we talked him into it, and we played Maple Leaf Gardens, and, you know, they configured it for 10,000 seats, and we sold them all. Went from 2,500 seats to 10,000. So it was, but I still miss not playing Massey Hall. That's all.
That blows my mind. And the other thing that blows my mind about you guys as far as playing live, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, but you never, ever toured or shared a show with Rush, right?
Correct. Yeah, we never did.
Crazy.
The only time we ever saw the Rush boys was in airports, you know, usually at O'Hare, because everybody's making a connection there for to go somewhere.
Right.
So we'd chat, you know, a little bit, and then go get our flights, and that was pretty much it. You know? But
that always blew my mind. two legendary Toronto trios and never ever did a show together anywhere. And sadly, you know, well, you guys are basically retired, and then obviously losing Neil, that opportunity will never happen. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it is true.
So, well, Mike,
it's weird. I never understood why that never happened, but it didn't. So yeah. What do you think?
Yep, it is. Well, listen, Mike, it's great to visit with you. Please send my best to Gil and Rick, and everybody check out the Allied Forces 40th anniversary, Record Store Day, June 12th, July 17th. More information at triumphmusic.com. And looking forward to the documentary when it's ready and it's out and I get a chance to see it. I'm sure we'll be talking again.
All right. Great, Eddie. Thanks a lot. Always great to be with you.
You too, Mike. Take care. We'll talk soon.
Okay, buddy. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, thanks to Mike. Again, as I said earlier, the documentary, it's now been announced, will be coming out in the fall on Triumph. Greatly looking forward to that. The Allied Forces Special Edition is out now. Thanks earlier to Alex Lifeson as well. Look forward to that new music from him and see what the next page in his music career looks like. And thank you for listening to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Again, it's available every Thursday wherever you get your podcast, totally free. Be sure to subscribe and make sure you listen. And be sure to join me for Trunk Nation on Sirius XM Volume Channel 106. If you're in the U.S. or Canada and you're not already on board, come on board and join us for Rock Talk every day, live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Channel 106. Nightly re-airs, 10 to midnight Eastern. Anything you want, anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. And again, the Alex Lifeson interview, there's video available. There's video for some of these interviews you can only get on the app if you're a Sirius XM subscriber. So I hope you join me if you are not already listening daily on Trunk Nation on Volume. Don't forget there's a sixth Sirius XM show. That's on Mondays, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern on Channel 39 Hair Nation. The terrestrial radio show, the website, the social media. Keep up with everything going on through the social media. Thanks to Joel Pollack for producing, and I'll see you guys next Thursday, hopefully on the radio every day, but if not, on the podcast here next Thursday for another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Have a good week.
Hey there. I host a show called Therapy Gecko, where I dress up as a lizard and talk to anonymous strangers from the internet about their lives. They tell me their relationship problems.
I found out that I was related to the guy that I was dating.
Their hobbies.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
Their secrets.
When we did not have toilet paper, I would use the shower curtain.
And also sometimes kind of serious stuff.
I have anxiety when I talk to people.
I'm also sometimes joined by celebrity guests like Doja Cat, Lil Yachty, Bobby Lee, and Eric Andre. Some of the more interesting calls we've gotten recently include a guy who argued with a demon living on his wall, a caller drunk at his job at a middle school, and a caller wondering whether or not he should transform into a dog. So if you're sick of your own life and you want to get lost in the life of a stranger, search for Therapy Gecko wherever you get your podcasts.